Brooklyn.
Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. Hey, everybody, I'm Dr. Lisa. Thanks for listening. So here at the Radio Free Brooklyn studios, it is Radio Free Brooklyn is the absolute best radio station in the Western Hemisphere. And I mean, it's been documented many times, and I'm really glad that you're listening in. And you know, the thing is, like right now, it's really important to help support media that says whatever the fuck we want to say. So you should go to our Patreon page on RadioFreeBrooklyn.com/Patreon and donate just a little bit of money. Come on, you know, give up one of those Starbucks or anything. And I think, is it still tax deductible? I don't know. We got to find out. But you're not going to give us enough money that it's going to make a difference. Anyway, so things are going well. I think they're going well. Maybe getting some work. That always makes, that helps my self-esteem. Like I was just saying that no matter what you get, if you get paid for it, it will help your self-esteem. So if you've been filling out any job applications at fast food restaurants, whatever it is, it's good for you. Okay. So my guest today, I'm very, very excited to have him on. He's right here. He's giggling to himself. Are you going to be giggling? Are you blushing? It's Sean J. Patrick Carney. Do you guys know who he is? He's a multifaceted, multi-talented person. So I was trying to think of how I can describe him to you folks. If you don't know who he is, you should look him up. Go to his website, humorandtheabject.com. That's abject, A-B-J-E-C-T, and look him up. But here's all the titles. Well, this is the title of his general website. So these are all the categories that he has mastered. I know he doesn't want to hear me say that, but I'm going to tell you that I think he's mastered them. Performance, visual art, video art, writing, humor and the eject. He's knocked that out of the park. And then about, he's had like, you know, he has interviews. He writes for like all these art publications. So when he came in today as a way of warming up, I let him know that I was intimidated by him, which I think is like the best way to start, make somebody feel awkward the minute they walk in so that it's all uphill. But we had a kind of interesting discussion. Let me just tell you really quickly why I'm intimidated by him, and then we'll get his reaction. We had a little chat about it, but let's see how it goes now. So the thing is that Sean and I are interested in some of the same areas, right, Sean?
Indeed.
And those areas are humor and art and the intersection of them, right? But Sean is way more, I don't know, smarter, intellectual. He's a great writer. He knows shit. He's read a lot, more than I have, and he's able to write very well about this. And on the other hand, he's also managed to form relationships with all the people that I look up to. So basically, Sean is part of the cool crowd. So Sean, does that make any sense to you?
I mean, thank you for saying that. I'm both a little bit embarrassed by it, because I'm embarrassed by most things, but it's a really nice compliment. Thank you. And I think I said to you before we went on air that I understand the feeling, because I'm intimidated by a lot of people. People who I don't know if they would know that I'm very intimidated by them, but it's a pretty frequent thing for me.
So you handle it better than I do. Like, you don't just go blurt out to them that you're intimidated by them.
I'm too intimidated to tell them that I'm intimidated by them. I think so. You're a step ahead of me. You're a little more self-actualized in that regard.
Well, I don't know, but I know that if we were going to do therapy here today, that I needed to tell you this counter transference, or otherwise, this is what I was afraid I would do. I was afraid that I would wind up attacking you.
Attacking me?
Because I would either be jealous or intimidated or you know, something like feeling lesser than. So I put it out there right away. And actually,
I don't think you should feel that way at all.
Well, I actually feel like about a billion times more comfortable than I did with you like 20 minutes ago. So,
well, I felt uncomfortable because when I came in, the iPad took a photo of my face and I didn't know. You have to check in when you come in the building for anybody who's listening.
That's right.
And I signed in and then it took a photo of my face and I really was at a bad angle and it shot kind of from below. And I looked very funny. So I was immediately put in my place right when I got
that,
here. So.
That is humbling. Yeah. It's like being at the motor vehicle. Yeah, any unexpected photograph of anybody is a very humbling
It's a great
experience.
Equalizer, I feel like. Yeah, for sure.
So there's so many things that we could talk about because you have so many different, you know, areas that are really interesting that I'm interested about comedy and art and I'm... You started out performing as a musician, is that right?
Yeah. I have played in, well, not in years, but from the time I was maybe like 14 or something, I was playing in bands probably until I was too old to play in bands, but I haven't done
any. Look at the Rolling Stones. When did that happen?
I don't know.
So is that, were you interested in music before you were interested in art?
I think I was more interested in music as something that I thought that I could pursue simply because it was something a lot of my neighbors did, other people in my town. Even though I grew up in this really small town in northern Michigan, I mean, mm-hmm. not super small, it's probably about 20,000 people or something, mm-hmm. but that's, you know, compared to New York, that's nothing.
How many high schools?
There were two proper high schools, like a West High School, which I went to, mm-hmm. and then another one that was called Central instead of East. It had just been called Central beforehand. They didn't change the name afterwards. And then a couple, like religious high schools, but
save money on the stationery.
Yeah. And, but there were, you know, we had Battle of the Bands and there were, one of my neighbors when I was growing up, he was in this band and was kind of like a micro celebrity uh-huh, in town. And uh-huh. he was a couple years older than me, sort of like a de facto big brother. I played guitar and I sang, but I can play.
Were you the front guy?
I was.
Yeah, I know. Did you write any music? Did you write?
Yeah.
You wrote the songs?
I did.
You wrote the lyrics and the music?
I did, but I was in the last band, the one that I was in for a while, which was in Tempe, Arizona, which is where I went to college. I was in it with this other guy named Mike Jones, not the rapper, but just this guy, Mike Jones. And Mike and I were kind of we did everything. He also sang and played guitar. And so we co-wrote everything, and he was a far more talented musician and singer than I was, but he would humor me and let me kind of yell sometimes.
So when did you become interested in art?
I would draw and stuff when I was younger and had a certain aptitude.
Did you study art in college?
Yeah, I ended up going to art school. I went to Michigan State for 2 years and then I transferred to Arizona State and I was doing printmaking, which uh-huh. Was sort of fun. And I think I thought that was maybe a medium that was a little less hoity-toity than painting or sculpture.
Why was hoity-toity an issue and even something that you were thinking about? That's interesting to me.
I don't know if I was really, really conscious of it, but I just felt like that was the aesthetic of that was stuff that I responded to as a kid. I really liked rock posters and things like that. And this was a type of art making that came out of typically like mass production.
Oh, you wanted to make rock band posters.
I did for a while. And I was in a rock band. But
you make your own posters for the band?
We did make the posters.
Did you make the posters?
I made some of them, yeah.
Yes.
But Mike was also a printmaker. So that's how we met. We met in a woodblock printing class is where I met him. But I always just thought it was kind of fun. I also liked the act of being able to make a lot of something and trade with people. And I think that came out of before the internet when I was, the internet existed, but when I was younger, it was really, I would order zines and I would get a zine and then you could buy like CDs or tapes out of it. And so there was this kind of weird trading cheap economy going on.
I could see that, how that fed into your work. That's a really interesting weird way to develop a creative practice or unique. Do you think some of that was because you were like in a small town and you didn't have access to
100%. Yeah. It was pretty, there wasn't a lot going on when I was in high school. So my friends and I just invented this thing called, we invented a scene. We just made one up and we started, we found out that you could rent VFW halls or UAW halls or this little opera house in our town for like a few hundred bucks.
Oh.
And so we started,
surprising.
So we started putting on shows, you know, you charge $5 for people to come or something, and we'd make enough money to be able to pay a band from Grand Rapids or something to come up. It was kind of big. And so we kind of, we didn't see any type of scene happening besides, like I said, like the Battle of the Bands at the high school. There were lots of people playing music, but nothing that was really run by the kids. And so we just sort of put something together. And then that was, I think, my first taste of understanding that if you kind of act like you have your shit together, people will give you more opportunities to keep proving it, you know?
Yeah, I've noticed that. That's an obstacle for me, see?
we would just send bands an email, you know, on AOL, because that's what we had, was I had AOL dial-up, and we would send them like a message and say, hey, we've got this, you know, music scene going on up here. We'd love you to play. People really like your stuff, because they would sell Michigan band CDs in the record store.
When you're in high school, I think people really respond to high school kids, don't you think, too? I think it's a real compliment from a high school kid to reach.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I work with teens right now in art education.
Do?
Yeah, and it's very, very fun. I mean, I was a high school teacher after undergrad for a little while, and I think I had this kind of feeling like I was supposed to teach college if I wanted to be taken seriously. And I did do that for a long time. But just this last year, I've gotten back into working with high school age students, and I love it.
I'm going to make sure that you meet our station director, Tom Tenney, after this, because we want to start a high school program. We are actually starting a high school program, and we need some advice and stuff like that.
Oh, so that's cool. If I don't have the advice, I can point you to the smarter people who do have it. But.
No, see, you're very self-deprecating. Because that's
Irish
what the
Catholic
word abject is. So let's find out more. Let's find out more about you. So I didn't expect this, but you've been in therapy now, right?
About a half a decade.
Half a decade. And tell us how you started therapy.
I started going because around probably 31, I had moved to do a job in Richmond, Virginia at the Virginia Commonwealth University. And it was a pretty huge life change. I had been in Portland, Oregon for about 6 years before that. And that was where I really kind of, I guess, cut my teeth with like the art community and feeling like, oh, I could be, I think I can be an artist. This is actually, and then I went there and I had never even been there before I took the job and moved on a plane.
Brave.
And I got there and I didn't really know anybody, and I didn't have any community or friends. And I had also a relationship had ended when I moved there.
So you felt isolated.
Yeah, I'd quit smoking when I went there. It was just like a lot of life changes at once. And typically, I think I've been pretty good at just sort of head down, barrel through that. But this was like a moment where all of a sudden I realized that I'm not handling this really well. And maybe it's not weird or weak to go talk to somebody. I mean, I definitely had that socialization that it going to that meant there's a stigma associated with
it. That's a weird thing to do.
Yeah, I think especially as not to get all gender binary about it, but as a socialized man, I was sort of like, oh no, is there, you know, this or that, and which in hindsight is all bullshit, it was a bit of a hurdle to get over.
I imagine. So I'm getting this sense that perhaps you're from a small town in the Midwest. And Irish Catholic. Is there, like, I'm getting this sense that there may not have been like a lot of creativity encouraged in your, or just naturally in your family, or
ironically, there was. I mean, I have a really wonderful immediate family. I'm really fortunate in that. My mom was an interior designer. So we always had colored pencils and stuff like that around the house. I would go to her work sometimes when I had summers off, because she had to work all year. And then my dad was a social worker for the local high school. So very kind of creative and empathetic people. And I don't think either one of them would have ever called themselves an artist. But my dad had musical instruments in the house and really loved music. And so really supportive environment in that sense.
You're right. Yes.
But I think that I felt a distinct learning curve when I went to art school, because I didn't know anything about art. I could draw. And at my high school, that was sort of, oh, you can draw, you should pursue art.
Right.
But I didn't know anything about art at all, or how to talk about it.
So that make you uncomfortable? Did you feel like you couldn't ask, or did you feel like you were behind? Or
what? Oh, yeah, I felt like a poser. I felt like a definite poser when I went to art school. Well, if I could tell 18-year-old me that right now, I think that would skip a lot of BS that I kind of...
So how did you manage that? Did you have friends, or did you try to like hide who you were, or how'd you manage it?
I just tried to really take my assignments seriously and meet people and learn how to do stuff. But even when I finished, I mean, I transferred schools, but that's just because I wanted to get out of the Midwest. I felt like I was kind of in this bubble. I should have just taken an airplane 45 more minutes to like LA or something, but I had a friend living in Tempe, Arizona, and you know, I had been out there maybe once to Arizona in my life, and I went, and it was winter in Michigan, and there were palm trees everywhere in Arizona. It was 75 or 80 degrees, and I thought, this is where I got to be. He has a pool at his apartment complex. So.
Right, that's...
So I just moved out there, but I think it was... I had some aspirant models that were... some people who in my program at Arizona State were like a few years older than me. They were either graduate students or they were people who just had gone to college a little later. And they kind of had these really great, you know, their garage, they turned into like a studio at their house, and they were putting on shows at like, you know, I don't know, like goofy places like restaurants or whatever, but they were just like doing stuff. Yeah. And that made me... And that made me feel like, oh, you can just kind of, there isn't necessarily a code to crack. It's just all these things can exist at the same time. And I don't think I had the vocabulary to articulate it at the time, but it might have been an early indication to me that this concept that I had of what the art world was certainly fictional. And this idea of it being a monolith is sort of silly because there are all of these art worlds at the same time. And and it's okay to not participate in... Like, I mean, come on, what percentage of people actually show in Chelsea? You know, like really out of the people.
Or even if they do, are they really artists?
Yeah. And so I think it was really like, I had a lot of people who, I think I've become comfortable with using the term mentor now. Had a lot of mentors, even if they didn't maybe see themselves as such, like definitely some cool older kids that I just kind of like latched onto. Sort of wedged my way into being their roommates, you know, like lived in their houses with them and learned a ton, and they kind of showed me how to do things. And
well, you seem like you're really good at like making things happen for yourself and for other people, which like it sounds like that seemed like a crazy move to you said you were in our I want to make sure I get this right. Yeah, you moved to Arizona, or you were in Arizona?
I moved to Arizona when I was about 20.
You transferred there.
Yeah, I transferred the middle of college.
So in other words, like that might not have been the exact right situation for you, but you just did something. You are not afraid of doing things, right? You take...
I guess so. I hadn't really thought of it like that.
Which is a really good... the word defense came to mind, which has a negative
connotation. I know what you mean. Yeah,
but it is really good. So... Let's talk about what you're in therapy. What do you talk about in therapy now? Let's see if I can do something.
This is funny because this is, I didn't mention it before we got on the air, but this is sort of, in a sense, the third time I've participated in therapy this week. And that's because yesterday morning I had my like regular, you know, like I go see the woman that is my therapist.
Every other week.
I would love to go every week. But the night before, on Tuesday, the show that I had mentioned to you before we hopped on the mics that I had gone to is this performance artist, Becca Kaufman, who performs under the name Jennifer Vanilla. And she does this monthly at a place called the Windjammer in Ridgewood. And I had been meaning to go for a long time and hadn't been able to go, but... I'm actually going to be interviewing her this week, and she had this woman, Alexandra Tatarsky, was performing, whom I had just interviewed for my podcast a little bit before that. So I was like, oh, I got to go to this. But the premise of their show was that it was a group therapy session.
Oh, really?
Wow,
that sounds so cool.
Which was really kind of neat and sort of funny, because I actually had to leave that early because my therapy session on Wednesdays at 8 o'clock in the morning in Dumbo. So I have to get up at like 6:15 or 6:30 to get there. So I couldn't stay through the group one, and then I was just kind of laughing because I was like, oh, and then I'm going on Dr. Now, Lisa on Thursday. So this is...
So how did they do it, though? I'm curious about the show. They, so interesting.
They most of it was sort of like the performers were plants in the audience. And so they were like, they had, you know, these people who were coming forward with like bringing something to group, but they were clearly the people
so
who were on the bill.
Fantasy.
But yeah, but they were also like, getting people from the audience to talk about stuff and things, but it was a really funny format. We all sat in a circle.
Sounds
very weird, kind of hard to tell where the veil was and what was real and things like that. Yeah.
So there was a circle and an audience as well.
The audience was this giant circle of people.
Was
yeah.
The circle. Yeah. Okay, that's what.
So
I was thinking.
It was pretty funny.
Wow. I want to. Are they doing it again? I'm going.
I don't know if they'll. I think the format might be different every single like. As I said, this was my first one, so I don't know what the other ones have been like, but I've watched videos of them, and I don't think that they're all group therapy sessions.
Okay, well, we're going to check that out at Windjammer. What's the artist's name?
Becca Kaufman is
Becca
her name.
Kaufman
Jennifer Vanilla is the character name. But
definitely
yeah,
gonna check
I think
that
it's
out.
First Tuesdays in the month.
So what's going on in therapy right now for you?
Oh, you want to guess?
No, I don't want to guess. I want to get to the point. I want to work this out. I want to do the job.
I have depression. And so sometimes when I'm doing therapy, it's because I'm having a pretty intense time. And so it's a very like, this feel like I have to go and talk to somebody because the people around me in my life are extremely generous and wonderful people, or they wouldn't be like my loved ones. But, some of the stuff that I need to talk about, I don't want to put it on anybody else. And so I go for that reason. But even, you know, I think I don't think that I have a manic depressive kind of condition, but I certainly do have a spectrum of kind of where I'm feeling, you know, and how I'm feeling. And so even if things are going relatively well and I'm feeling pretty good, I still think it's important for me to go. Just like somebody said to me once, it's kind of like, you know, just because you're in shape, you don't stop going to the gym. And while I don't personally know that situation, but I understand the concept of it.
No, I mean, also, I think that's a really good point, guys, that, you know, you don't want to put everything on your loved ones, because I think that does really hurt a lot of, or that puts a lot of stress on relationships. And I mean, I've certainly done it a lot, where, you know, you've got a lot going on in your life, and those other people, that other significant other or whoever, they just, it's not, they can't handle it all. They've got their own shit, and it's good to work it out on your independence, work it out on your own.
Yeah.
It's
hard to remember when it's you who's going through it, because I've definitely been on the other side of that, with both like friendship and romantic relationships before, where somebody, and now I feel a little bit silly about how I, when I was younger, the way that I reacted, but sometimes I get very frustrated with somebody and just kind of think, you know, nothing's actually wrong. I don't get why can't you just see the bigger picture, blah, blah, blah. And then, the ironic thing was that I would have the exact same thing happen to me, but I wouldn't be able to zoom out and think, oh, weird, I'm doing exactly what I just got frustrated with somebody for doing. But
thank God for therapists.
Yeah, so I think that's where that's a useful thing. I'm glad that it's been sort of socially destigmatized. Recently.
I mean, in my world, you know, well, there aren't a lot of I'm stigmatized. Yeah, that's the least of it.
It's just inaccessible. I mean, that's the unfortunate thing.
That is true.
I don't have health insurance. I'm fortunate that I see somebody who is able to do like a sliding scale thing with me that's, income dependent. Mm-hmm. And that's extremely helpful. But I am really, really lucky that's the situation, because I had insurance when I started going, they made an arrangement with me afterwards, which was, you know,
that's great.
Really helps, especially when you're transitioning out of having insurance, to be able to continue to see a therapist, because usually transitioning out of insurance means something else in your life is happening. So
absolutely. So this has been an intense. So is your depression circumstantial, do you think? Or have you thought, have you ever tried medication? Are you on medication?
I haven't tried it. I'm not somebody who's opposed to it. I admit some ignorance about it in general. I haven't been, it hasn't been suggested to me. I mean, it has, but not, if somebody that I was speaking to professionally sort of, you know, sat me down and said, I really think that you could benefit from this, I would be open to it.
Right.
It just had, I've had it like mildly suggested, but not really like brought up again.
So do you feel like, is your depression, does it come out as anxiety or does it come out as?
It's a mixture. I think the way that I've tried to describe it before is, even if I'm not currently having a depressive episode, it's sort of like this nagging feeling that's going on constantly, that's basically saying, you know, don't get too excited, because, you know, in a couple weeks, like, this is going to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's like, well, I don't actually have a thing at the moment that I'm upset about. And it's like, you know, the way that people describe it often, it's difficult to articulate, and it might seem irrational, because I've had, you know, moments where things are technically, from an outsider perspective, going great, but there's just a weird thing in the back of your head, I think, when you have depression, that basically is consistently telling you that you don't deserve happiness, if that makes sense.
Well,
or that it will be, if you get too happy, that there's just going to naturally, it's going to even itself out.
No, well, see, here's the thing. I have no formal training, and I'm in no position to really say any of this, but except that I'm here saying it. But I think that if you have, like you're describing, sort of a feeling of dread almost, and if that's constant no matter what, that's the kind of stuff that I think medication can help. I was actually an inpatient on study on medication.
Really?
On Prozac in the 80s.
Whoa.
Really old. So, and I had struggled with depression, and then, and my father had serious depression. So medication, and I mean, medication helped me, but I also had a lot of other emotional issues. But I don't think I'd be as functional as I am now if I hadn't. You seem like really highly functional. I don't know if, you know, I don't know how depressed you are, but if it's a constant feeling, that could be an indication that medication could be helpful, I think.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think I have a pretty high functioning capacity, regardless of, I don't think that most people around me would have, except those closest to me, would have any idea, what's going on. I'm pretty good at, and I've been, you know, had this brought up to me before by people, that it's almost weird or unsettling that I can be having essentially like a serious anxiety attack, and like be very, very, very upset and really like kind of losing my shit. But if people are coming over, like the second the doorbell rings, I can just like snap and like put on hey, what's up? And like
I'm
have
getting.
Somebody come in, and I had always thought for most of my life, I was like, well, that's good that I can do that. And then I've had, you know, plenty of people tell me like, it's kind of a weird.
No, I could see you being like that. Well,
to just like flip on a dime, because I'm not really being myself at that moment. I think I'm not being disingenuous in an attempt to like fool somebody, but I'm trying to play like host or play like this or that. And
well,
so
you're being self-protective.
Yeah.
Do you feel responsibility for other people? Did you feel any responsibility for people growing up or making things happen?
Maybe. I mean, I haven't really sussed that out, but I could see where that's a thing. I mean, I feel a lot of like proxy anxiety.
What does that mean?
Like anxiety for other people.
And how would that be in your family?
I don't know.
Did your mom have like presentations or, I mean, they sound like great parents. They sound a lot more open-minded than I initially guessed.
Yeah, they are great. I don't know. Like, I mean, I feel insane anxiety constantly that one of them is going to die and leave the other one, and then I don't live anywhere near them. And I haven't for my entire
your
adult
brothers
life.
Brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I have two younger sisters. They both live in Denver. And my folks still live in Michigan. So there's this like...
Are you the oldest?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so there's a weird thing constantly where I'm also just like, I haven't lived near my parents in 15 years. And they're, I mean, they're like, they like run 5 miles a day. They're like very, they're like, okay.
Yeah.
But there's still a, just this weird thing that I feel... anxiety for other people, like when I watch somebody getting dragged on social media, I'm like really upset for them, like upset on behalf of them or something. I mean, not if they deserve it.
Well, that's good.
But sometimes, you know, sometimes people.
So did you play the older brother role?
I suppose so. I mean, I am the older brother, but
right. No, but I mean, did you take responsibility for your siblings?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I babysat them and stuff like that, but they're both very independent people and didn't need I never felt like I had to like protect them
right
in any way, because my sister, they're also not that much, I mean, my youngest sister is only 5 years younger than me, so I'm 35, she's 30.
Right,
so we weren't that far apart in age, right. So we were sort of peers in a certain sense, but I was definitely their older brother, but I'd never had to I never really had to kind of like look out for them necessarily.
So here's what I'm wondering about. I'm wondering about if your family always like acted, there's something about you or your, I'm wondering about your upbringing, if there's a way of acting appropriately that was very important in your background.
Acting appropriately, like manners or how so?
All of that. Like, I don't even know, like, you know, it may be so ingrained. I mean, some of that sounds like small town Midwest, like don't be rude. Like, like the idea of whatever it is, don't be rude.
I think there's like there's an uncommunicated kind of Midwest Irish Catholic stoicism that's, I think, ingrained. Like, I've never seen either of my parents cry.
Okay.
They don't really react like that to things.
Right.
They're sensitive people, but right. They don't like, I never saw them fight. They don't really, I mean, they like will, you know, my dad, he like won't listen to map directions while he's driving. So there'll be like a moment where it's like, you know, it's like, oh my God, like, and they'll have like a thing, but it's not, you know what I mean? Like and that's what I meant earlier when I said that I was fortunate, like my parents as models of kind of how to sort of like solidify a family were very, very put together and not in a way that seemed forced. Mm-hmm. Like they still spend all their time. Now they just go on road trips. They have like a little trailer and they drive it around the country and they
sounds
go to
awesome.
Like different places. So they're just like old.
Do they ever have them come here?
They came here a little while ago. They came last fall, but they only came as far as the Adirondacks, so I went up and I camped with them, which was fun.
Do you miss them a lot?
Yeah.
I mean, does that weigh on you that you don't see them more?
Yeah.
I mean, not more than moving back to a small town, but...
I don't know if I'd have any... One. I wouldn't have a lot of career prospects in Traverse City, Michigan right now, but...
So, I have to do a station ID because I want to remind people that they're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, which is so amazing. It's such a great station. You know what's so great about the station, honestly, is inclusion. We have 70 different kinds of shows, and, like, you could just listen to us at any time and get, like, something different, and... It's a really great station, and we just moved to a new place, and we need like rugs, and we are really poor. We're really, really, really poor. So if you can help keep us going, go to our Patreon page. That's radiofreebrooklyn.com/Patreon, and, you know, send us some love. Just the support helps, even if it's like a dollar. Makes us feel good. We'll talk about it at the meeting and then give you a shout out on the air. I promise. I will personally. So I'm wondering if that's a cultural thing where there's like, how would somebody like you feel when you got to like, you know, art school, like from such a sort of background, like, but also what I was starting to think is, are your parents sort of like hiding? Not hiding, but I mean, is that three-dimensional? Is that real that they don't argue or they don't you know, that you didn't see your mom cry. Like, is that real?
Yeah, my mom's not a crier. It's just not in her DNA, I don't think. And no, they're very three-dimensional people, and we still have like weird, like there are like weird things about them that my sisters and I, you know, joke about and stuff like that. I mean, everybody's pretty open with each other and they're very supportive. It's just like a thing where, I mean, I don't really know how to describe it. It was totally normal to me growing up. Sure. And I think that I was pretty blown away when I would go to somebody's house whose parents were like screaming at each other. I was just like, did they seriously do that?
Mm-hmm.
Like while you're here mm-hmm. in front of you? And I feel really thankful that my folks didn't do that, but they also didn't. I mean, they were pretty pragmatic in terms of like the way that we lived never created those situations that I saw in that sometimes led to conflicts in other families where like money wasn't handled properly
mm-hmm.
or somebody did this or that. Mm-hmm. And let's be real. I feel like with marriages, like money is the mm-hmm. root of a lot of the arguments. Mm-hmm. And I think they were just we just didn't live beyond our means.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly weren't, we certainly didn't really have money, but we weren't, I didn't feel poor
right,
either.
They were pragmatic.
Yeah. They just like bought a house. Yeah. They bought a house in 1978. We never moved. They had it paid off before I graduated high school. Mm-hmm. They stayed at their jobs for mm-hmm. 30 years or mm-hmm. something. And now they're just road tripping.
Yeah. It sounds like a very stable environment.
Yeah. It's kind of weird. Which I think was part of the reason that it felt like, what am I trying to say here? It felt greedy to have depression.
Oh,
does that make sense?
Yeah. Like, self-indulgent.
Yeah. Yes. It felt very much like that. And then I think I found this book that I'd gotten in a sociology class mm-hmm. my freshman year of college mm-hmm. that we read that was called Saint Scholars and Schizophrenics. And it's a book that it's a document of mental illness in rural Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of how undiagnosed and how mm-hmm. traumatic and intergenerational mm-hmm. all this poverty and things like that mm-hmm. was and the famine. And I'm not one of those people who's like on Facebook being like, you know, the Irish were slaves once, because it's not, because that's not true. And Irish people are not marginalized. But just sort of an interesting history culturally of like alcoholism and mm-hmm. poverty mm-hmm. and Catholicism, which mm-hmm. is just like, shut up.
Right.
Don't.
Right.
We don't talk about this, you know, go pray. Or right. if you do something bad. And then the weird, like, being able to be absolved of anything that you've done by going to confession
that's
is,
hilarious.
Like, profoundly insane to me.
Were you brought up in a religious environment? Did your family go to church every week?
Yeah, we went to church every week, but they're Irish Catholic, which I think is more self-punishing than spiritual. Like, it's like, why do we have to go to church? Well, I had to go to church when I was your age. Like, we don't say grace. We didn't have a Jesus mm-hmm. hanging on the wall. I don't recall a Bible being in my home. I mean, right. I went to Catholic school.
Right. Right.
And
there's a certain discipline to all.
Yeah. And I was an altar boy. And my parents were very, like, I mean, I didn't think about it till I was older, but I just remember at one point, like, these two priests left the, and I don't know. I mean, I'm just like imagining, but these two priests that were the priests at my elementary school's associated parish,
mm-hmm.
both were just moved to Hawaii, like just out of nowhere, like late 80s.
Weird.
I mean, she's pretty par for the course for Catholic churches. I don't know, you know, I don't know what they're doing. So I'm not going to say like their names or the name of the parish or something, but they just disappeared.
That's so weird.
And then this new priest arrived and my parents were just like, we don't like him. They just didn't like him and they would never tell us why. And so we ended up, we would drive 20 miles outside
probably
of town.
Child molester.
I think they suspected that that might be what was going on. And I don't know if it was. But we would drive 20 miles outside of town and I would go and be an altar boy at this other church called St. Joseph's with this guy, Father Fred, who just like ruled. Like if he, like, you know, like Catholics are all about service and all this stuff, mm-hmm. but really it's all bullshit mm-hmm. and everybody like thinks Catholics are hilarious and like a joke.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was like a really good person.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, I really looked up to him and I thought he was cool. And I mean, he was old, but he ran this thing called the Father Fred Foundation that I, even when I was like completely secularized by high school, I would mm-hmm. still go volunteer at the Father Fred Foundation. It was basically this giant thrift store, but everything was free
mm-hmm.
and anybody could come And I mean, it was, you know, it was an honor system.
That is
really
cool.
showed your ID so they could kind of, mm-hmm. you know, if it was somebody mm-hmm. who came in six times a week and was only taking like vintage mm-hmm. clothes, they'd be like, why don't you not come back? But so we went out to church there. So I had kind of a cool experience being an altar boy. I really liked working with Father Fred, and he would.
Was he like a mentor? You seem to have mentors.
Yeah, a little bit. He was like super nice.
But somebody and just that like, you respected.
Yeah, and didn't make me do confession or any of this other stuff and wasn't weird and didn't like...
Had a cool attitude.
Yeah, he was just nice and like was just into like spreading the word, but not like a jerk about it or whatever. He only preached from the pulpit and then just like knocked it off and could be social and did all this stuff for the community. And then he passed away, but it was... He was like a cool dude, and I think that I was fortunate that I didn't have the experience that a lot of other people had growing up religiously, because even though I think some of the larger things about Catholicism I always joke are like, oh, well, I'm Irish Catholic, so of course I feel like shit because I just, you know, got a paycheck or something, so I feel bad about it. But all things considered, it was relatively mellow. But again, that's where this like...
Yeah, I could see that.
The idea of feeling bad seemed self-indulgent later.
And also, I'm wondering if your parents didn't have like... I mean, not that it's necessarily bad, but I don't think you might have been exposed to like a huge range of emotions, good and bad, you know?
No, not particularly.
So they may... Especially in the world that you're functioning in, you're much more likely to see all this stuff, and it may... You know, imagine you're excited by it, but it also is probably not always comfortable.
Yeah. Well, I think I was very, when I mentioned earlier that it all sort of came to a head when I moved to Virginia, it was also the first time that I didn't have like a fuck ton of stuff going on all the time, mm-hmm. which is a really easy distraction. So even if you're feeling, you know, I remember feeling this way in high school and things, but I was also like playing in a band. I was playing soccer. Yeah. I was like I wasn't an altar boy in high school, but I was just like in student government. Like I just had a lot of stuff going on. Yeah. I was like the token illustrator, and I didn't get elected in. It was pure nepotism. The kids who got elected put me in student government because I could draw the stuff for the floats and the other things like that. So I got like an honorary. I was like the cultural attaché or something.
But you could work with them. So what's going on in your life right now? What's the biggest stressor in your life right now, do you think?
The biggest stressor in my life right now. I mean, I guess it's kind of trying to think about when you know, I said earlier, you know, I played in bands until it was like too late to play in bands or something. Mm-hmm. And so even though I know that that's not necessarily a germane thing to be asking myself, I think a lot of it with art has to do with that. And I'm kind of wondering what is the, and a lot of it is outside of just my own personal thing, but like what's the value of art right now, especially contemporary art and living in a place like New York City, and wondering if that's, you know, I mean, is that the hill I want to die on? Being a cheerleader for art, and I love art, and I love going to see art, and I love my friends who are artists and stuff. But you know, I'm sure I've had conversations with people. I think a lot of people feel like this. But like, is this with the state of the world? Is this like not a little bit self indulgent? But then again, it's like it brings me a lot of joy, and it connects me with people that I love and think are super cool.
You know, there's an interesting word you used, cheerleader. Mm-hmm. And that brought me back to, why are you laughing?
Because I feel like I'm a cheerleader for a lot of stuff.
No, but see, this is what's interesting, because and listening to one of your, an old interview and doing my research on you, as I mentioned before you came in, that you had a professor that said you had done a character and you didn't put your name on it. And I wonder, and I've been wondering this, if there's some way that you don't make where you are not the center of the work, where a lot of the work is helping. I mean, you do great things and you pick great people, but a lot of it is, and I do this too. I mean, a lot of this is about the other artists, but it's not really you. You know what I'm saying. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I think...
I wonder if you miss the reward that you would get by it being about you more.
I don't know if... I think that the thing is that I see other people who are so good at things that I respect, and I would rather watch them do their thing, and if and maybe try to help create a context for that to happen, because I just know that they're going to do it better than I can do it. And that's, and I think I tried to, you had asked me before we started if I had tried to like pursue stand up, or if that's what I wanted to do. And when I was younger, like, yeah, I was like, I could be a stand up comedian and stuff, but I'm not like great at it. I really enjoy, like, once a year I write like a long performance piece that is structured around a thing. I make a bunch of objects and I do like one a year, and it makes me feel great and I love it. And I usually am sometimes playing a character and things like that, but that's like, I got to spend a lot of time on it and all these things. And the rest of the year though, I think that because I never really developed a practice of, I have some friends who have this practice where they feel a compulsion to paint all the time.
Yeah.
They've got to make paintings. And I don't feel that. I kind of lost that with, like playing music. I don't feel a compulsion to pick up an instrument and write music. I used to a lot, but I think as I'm getting older now, I have, there's all this stuff that interests me and people that I'm interested in. So I just kind of want to like tag along. And like I said before, be a cheerleader for them. So it's like the whole reason to do, the Human the Abject podcast that I do is like, I mean, it's both a thing to promote other people's stuff that I love, but it's also a little bit selfish. Like, I want to sit down with these people and talk for an hour. Like, I want to pick somebody's brain and and get to know them and like and be cool by proxy, you know, just by like my being like, oh, like this person, I got to interview them and they're cool and now we're buddies and whatever is like, is actually super rewarding to me. Like,
no, and I get that. I'm just, I mean, I'm just so... Okay, so I'm Sean J. Patrick Carney's advocate. And I think that he has what it takes to be alongside of those people.
Oh, thanks. Sometimes I get to be, and I feel like I only...
But I wonder if it's, there's some, okay, so here's a thought. I'm not right. I don't know anything. I have no training. But here's a thought. The thought is that you've talked. I've noticed that you talk about being selfish a lot.
I feel really selfish.
And that, I'm wondering if that's getting in your way. I think that that's part of that maybe your Catholic upbringing, and it is awesome. But we all know, like all the people that I think, all the people that. And I'm attracted to the same people for the or their work, not just them, their work, same thing, have quite a bit of selfishness, no?
I think when it's instrumentalized properly, it's really great. And I admire that in people.
I do too, but I'm wondering if you have some inner conflict about what your idea of being selfish is and what it really means and all that stuff. Is that something you've thought about?
I don't think that I've let myself think about it, but I think it's sort of creeped in here and there, but I've gone, go away.
Yeah, I think that, see, this is what I'm thinking. When you started talking about one of the things about art is that you don't know if it's, the way that I interpret it, like, is there any meaning in this? Is there any meaning in, like, being involved in all this crap that no one gives a shit about, why we're going to be blown up by Kim Jong-un? Okay. And, but then I also wonder at the same time if there's something, I feel frustrated on your behalf. I am in your role many, many times, and I feel frustrated on your behalf because I think that you may be missing a connection with your own work by the role that you are comfortable in, which is a non-selfish role. And I mean, I'm just
That's a good
spouting
point.
Crap.
That's a good point. And I feel like I've been trying to figure out how to. So I've been a teacher for a while, but I also, you know, for years I did arts administration because that's how you get a full time job at a college. You teach a little bit.
You're great at it. Look what you did for the Bruce. This guy made the Bruce High Quality Foundation owes so much to this guy, I'm telling you. He really did some really great shit with
Andrea Arubla, too, who was also let go before her time.
No, but really, See, but you couldn't just.
Well,
that's
it would,
right. Sorry,
it would be off. It would be ridiculous not to acknowledge her. Like
she's great,
incredible
she's great
impact on that. But I think though that those, I think something that I noticed in other people around me, and some of it has to do with I'm a few years older than some of the people that I kind of hang out with. And,
I get that. Look, you're talking to me, honey.
But I noticed that, you know, this thing that everybody sort of says, you know, in college, nobody taught me how to do this or this. And it has to do with just like ways to sort of basically just like keeping a calendar or organizing things or doing all keeping up with emails, doing all these things that I think don't come second nature to everybody. And for some reason, I have an aptitude for mm-hmm. anal retentive mm-hmm. stuff like mm-hmm. that. It's probably why I like editing a podcast, mm-hmm. like because it's just I just sit there.
That would make me crazy.
But I think that the I have been trying to figure out, and ever since I interviewed Anna Fabrega, whom I love, mm-hmm. and I put out a couple books for her, and she called me a comedy administrator. I've been thinking about. I've obviously gravitated more towards comedy than art mm-hmm. in. I don't know, over the last 15 years or so, mm-hmm. while keeping a foot in both camps, because I do love both. Mm-hmm. But I started to think about, you know, in the way that conceptual artists of the 60s and things like that, or even relational aesthetics, like, can I do something that's like that, that instead of instrumentalizing other people to make my work for me, like, is part of my practice that I can do this like, kind of dorky stuff that other people don't want to do? And if I can do that and I get to go along for the ride and have fun and be sort of part of this scene, then I'm interested in doing that. But it would be untruthful of me to say that sometimes I don't wish like, oh man, I wish I was on this lineup. Like,
you
of
do
course.
Wish
oh,
that.
Of course. Yeah.
You do.
But every time that it's done, I'm like, oh man, that would like, I could never be as funny as like Lorelai Ramirez. Like I could never even come close, but I get to sometimes I perform with her, like mm-hmm. we will do stuff together, and I just kind of try to organize the thing and see if I can find us money so they can get paid. Mm-hmm. But I know better than to think that like these people have this knack that I understand and can intellectualize everything that they do. Mm-hmm. They just can do it. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I know that it's like I'm not going to just pick that up. Mm-hmm. I think I can do some things, but I don't know. It's an interesting question.
See, here's what I'm thinking when you're saying that, because I, you know, I feel that way a lot too when I watch, you know, I perform and I look at like somebody like those guys that you just mentioned. I'm like, whoa. Yeah. And it is great to be doing what you're doing, but I also wonder if there's part of you that there is something that you could own that you would be standing out all on your own. And I think like, you know, I feel that way too. I'm going to relate to you totally. But then I think about the stuff that I do on my own that has nothing to do with other people or isn't really, it's so not in competition with, because I'm competitive, it makes me crazy, all that stuff. So I do stuff that if I do something that I feel good about, even though it's not relatable to what anybody else is doing, then I at least go like, I made that. That's good. That happened. I made that happen. Okay, I feel good. So when I see other people who are better than me in everything, then I go, well, I can do this.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And actually, you know, it's helpful that you're sussing this out, because I think now that you're saying that when the Bruce High Quality Foundation University closed in August, and all of a sudden I was like, whoa, this thing that has really defined my entire network in New York and how mm-hmm. I met people is going away. You know, one part of me was sad and one part was really excited. And I think that's where I got the energy to do Humor in the Abject as mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. kind of what I was mm-hmm. focusing on. And so while it's a lot of it's writing about other mm-hmm. people's work and a lot of it is interviewing other people, mm-hmm. It's definitely like, it feels like mine, which Bruce mm-hmm. High Quality never did.
Okay.
Humor in the Abject really feels like mine in this thing that I'm making. And for anybody who's ever listened to a podcast episode, like I am interviewing somebody, but the bulk of the like 20 hours that goes into every episode, you know, there's like
really?
Research and all
They're
this stuff.
They're great. But, They're so good.
But it's like an excuse for me to make sound art. I mean, like a quarter of every episode is just insane sound collages that I'm making. No show has the same intro. No show has the same fake sponsors. No show has like
about that.
Yeah, those are every one of those is made up for the person. I mean, they're made sort of as like a little tribute and like a thank you to the people that I had on.
But
they're also like very much like, oh my God, I just remembered this song. I found the instrumental for it, and it would be hilarious if I mixed it with this ad for Quiznos or something, and then did all this other stuff on top of it. So it's
okay.
It's very like sculptural and related to music for me. But it gets to be this kind of like, it's there, but it's not like the focus is me talking to the person. A listener.
For sure.
I'm sure there are a lot of people that just skip or like, oh my God, he's doing the intro and like skip over it.
I'll be honest. I mean, I listened to two episodes recently and I was, because making this thing, which takes no tech, well, very little, nothing like yours. I mean, I was a little like, is he doing this for every episode?
Yeah.
Different.
Yeah, I'm doing my...
I mean, it's extreme what you're doing. It's awesome.
Yeah, I'm working on the 37th one right now and every one of them is, I mean, there's probably about 12 to 14 minutes on each one of just like really intense sound collages.
Yes.
I mean, and it's like, I think they sound sort of maybe a little bit, I think they sound silly and weird, but I hope that they come across as not like noise.
They're highly original. And see, this is what I'm thinking now. We only have 3 minutes left, so
I feel like we've gotten somewhere though, because I hadn't really said out loud that those are like my babies.
Okay.
Like I love making
those. That's really great.
But I can't show sound art. I would make fun of myself.
See, the whole thing is it's all about the process that it's about the process you're connected to. And you were talking about something in the process of what you're doing that you're connected to. So say you made up a character and you were the person you were interviewing, or you got rid of the interview
part.
That was
my thesis in grad school, was podcasts where I played all the characters.
Right.
So now it's I'm just doing it for real.
What if you made some stuff? Like, I'm just saying, could there be growth for you?
Yeah.
If you made some stuff, maybe sound, maybe you could make something that, to start with the sound, the thing that you love, the thing that you own, the thing that you're special at. You are special at this. I haven't heard anybody do anything like this because it's intense and crazy and obsessive. So you're obsessive about that. And if you focused on that area and developed that and made that more a bigger part of your practice and found out how you could present it, then that might actually make you a better interviewer because you'd be like, I'm good at this. Like you're good at stuff and you're hiding hiding it. That's my analysis.
I will say that I don't not have a Google Doc of things that I just haven't done that are things kind of like what you're saying, that I was like, I should do this and I should do this. But this is the first time I've said it out loud.
Should is horrible.
Yeah.
Should is horrible. I mean, but the thing is, it's like, I also think that you're looking at it from the point of view of something solid that you have to make, something disciplined, something organized. And I'm saying, you already talked about this thing that's fabulous. What if you figured out a way just to take that and shape it in some other form that doesn't involve somebody else's fabulousness besides yours?
That's true. I could just make a record.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, if you start out doing that or whatever, make a few songs or, you know, play them as songs on your show. And then that'll lead somewhere. It's not the end goal. It's just getting away from... Just be fucking selfish.
I was just going to say, you're telling me to be selfish.
Yes,
I like that.
Yes.
Okay.
And we have 30 seconds left. So I just want to remind everybody, thank you for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm so glad that we got to spend this time together today. Go to our website. Go to